Good morning. This is Ed Reedy from the Talking Information Center with the Sunday, February 22nd reading of the New York Times. Trump says he will raise global tariff to 15%. The move signaled that the president would press ahead with steep global import taxes despite the legal setback from the Supreme Court, by Tony Rahm and Anna Swanson. President Trump said on Saturday that he would raise his new global tariff to 15%, a day after he took steps to replicate some of the punishing duties that he had been struck down by the Supreme Court. Mr. Trump announced the sudden change in a post on social media and said the policy would take effect immediately, as he signaled that he would press ahead with his aggressive trade strategy despite suffering a major legal setback. For some countries, such as Britain and Australia, Mr. Trump's new 15% tariff will actually be higher than the rates that previously applied to their exports to the United States. For others, like China, Vietnam, India, and Brazil, the new rate will be significantly lower. The previous set of duties were invalidated on Friday after a majority of the court's justices found that the president did not have the authority to issue them. Mr. Trump had initially set his replacement global rate at 10% using a provision in a law never before invoked by a president that allows him to impose an across-the-board tariff for 150 days unless Congress agrees to extend it. In the directive, he indicated it would take effect after midnight on February 24th. The statute caps the rate at 15%, limiting the president's ability to lift it again, though Mr. Trump has signaled he plans to use other trade powers in the coming months to add further taxes on imports. I, as President of the United States of America, will be, effective immediately, raising the 10% worldwide tariff on countries, many of which have been ripping the U.S. off for decades, without retribution, until I came along, to the fully allowed and legally tested 15% level, the president wrote on Truth Social. During the next short number of months, the Trump administration will determine and issue the new and legally permissible tariffs, which will continue our extraordinarily successful process of making America great again, greater than ever before, he continued. Some White House staff members were caught off guard by the increase. People familiar with the matter said it came less than 24 hours after the president had announced his 10% rate. Since the decision, Mr. Trump has railed angrily against the Supreme Court justices who ruled against his tariffs and threatened to impose even bigger duties against the world. The ruling extends a period of uncertainty for companies and countries which have struggled to cope with the president's aggressive and fluctuating tariff threats since he officially embarked on his trade offensive last spring. The brinksmanship has strained alliances, rattled global markets, and challenged the U.S. economy, while leaving American businesses and consumers to shoulder some of the costs from taxes applied to their imports. But Mr. Trump has remained intent on tariffs, even in legal defeat. In reprising some of his duties, the president has doubled down on a strategy that he believes will raise money for the United States, encourage more domestic manufacturing, and achieve geopolitical objectives beyond trade. Mr. Trump has also leveraged the threat of tariffs to force other countries to reach favorable trade agreements with the United States. Many of those deals were cemented using tariffs issued under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA, the approach that the Supreme Court invalidated on Friday. Still, Mr. Trump has warned other nations that they should stick to trade deals they negotiated over the past year or risk being hit with new tariffs. Some of them stand, many of them stand, some of them won't, and they'll be replaced with the other tariffs, he said at a defiant news conference after the justices handed down their ruling. but the sudden removal of his emergency tariffs, which had encouraged other governments to make trade concessions to the United States, is still likely to raise doubts among foreign leaders about whether to keep the deals they agreed to. Some governments have faced domestic criticism for concessions made to the United States, like in India, where farmers have condemned Prime Minister Narendra Modi's move to open agricultural markets. Indonesia had just signed its trade deal with the United States on Thursday, adopting zero tariffs on American goods in return for a 19% tariff rate on its exports. The Trump administration has indicated that it will use other legal authorities, like Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, to impose tariffs on countries individually based on their trade practices. The administration has also suggested it could expand the national security-related tariffs it has issued on various industries, like steel, minerals, and cars, under Section 232 of the Trade Act of 1962. But those moves will take some time to prepare. In the meantime, exports from all countries will now face the 15% tariff rate, regardless of their trade practices or the concessions they've made. Some trade experts said that the flat rate could end up benefiting lower-cost producers in places like China and other Asian nations whose goods would be relatively cheap even after a 15% import tax. The new global tariff does have certain exemptions. Mr. Trump moved late Friday to carve out certain products, including beef and other agricultural products, which he had previously spared from the steepest import taxes to keep prices from rising. Nor will the new rate affect goods like foreign autos and steel, which are already subject to tariffs imposed on national security grounds. Mr. Trump preserved a policy that upholds the terms of a trade deal he previously brokered with Canada and Mexico, allowing imports covered by the pact to remain tariff-free. He also added some new exemptions to the tariffs. For example, for Central American countries included in a trade deal signed in 2004. Divide among Supreme Court's conservatives could test Trump's agenda. In rejecting President Trump's tariffs, the court's six conservative justices displayed subtle differences in their views of executive power. By Anne E. Marimo. President Trump's stinging defeat before the Supreme Court on Friday came because the court's six conservative justices splintered over the legality of Mr. Trump's tariffs. That divide underscored differing visions of presidential power and the role of Congress, and has implications for how the court may deal with future cases involving Mr. Trump's agenda. Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr. wrote the court's 6-3 majority opinion, which concluded that the president had exceeded his authority by using an emergency statute to impose sprawling tariffs on nearly every U.S. trading partner without congressional approval. The Chief Justice was joined by the court's three liberals and two of Mr. Trump's own nominees, Justices Neil Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, the president's third nominee, dissented along with Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel A. Alito, Jr., both staunch conservatives. The division appears in part to come down to how much deference the justices think a president is due after declaring an emergency and to their views of how much leeway Congress intended to give a president to conduct foreign affairs. Jonathan Adler, a law professor at William & Mary, said that while it was tempting to see a court with a conservative supermajority as a monolith, its ruling in the tariff decision highlighted a number of meaningful differences among the justices. The fractured decision, including the dueling written opinions from the conservative justices, reinforces that there are important and subtle differences in the way the conservatives understand the contours of executive power and its relationship to Congress, Professor Adler added. The division suggests that in cases related to presidential power, the Trump administration and those who have challenged its policies in court cannot assume that the justices nominated by Republican presidents will see things the same way. The split also creates ways for the court's liberals to potentially forge coalitions, particularly with the Chief Justice and Justice Barrett, that could make action at the court unpredictable in coming years. The separation has been less clear in the court's other recent interactions with Mr. Trump. In the months before the president returned to office, the court divided along ideological lines when it granted Mr. Trump substantial immunity from prosecution. Since then, the court's conservative majority has signed off on most of his emergency requests, temporarily allowing him to fire independent agency leaders without cause, remove transgender troops from the military, and remove deportation protections for hundreds of thousands of migrants. Those orders were unsigned, but members of the conservative bloc rarely noted that they disagreed with giving Mr. Trump his way. But those rulings were placeholders. The tariffs decision was the first time the court issued a final judgment about the legality of a piece of Mr. Trump's agenda. It will not be the last. The court is still weighing the president's authority to remove a member of the powerful Federal Reserve Board and whether he can fire independent regulators at will despite tenure protection signed into law. And on April 1, the court will hear arguments over whether Mr. Trump can end birthright citizenship. With so many other momentous cases pending before the court on issues on executive power, it is far too early to declare winners and losers this term when it comes to the president, said Gregory G. Garr, who served as the Solicitor General in the George W. Bush administration. In a defiant news conference after the court's decision was announced on Friday, Mr. Trump appeared to divide the conservative justices into two camps. He attacked the justices who ruled against him. "I'm ashamed of certain members of the court, absolutely ashamed for not having the courage to do what's right for our country," he said. He also said that Justices Gorsuch and Barrett joining the majority was an embarrassment to their families. "I don't want to say whether I regret nominating them," he added, concluding, "I think their decision was terrible." The president thanked the dissenting justices by name in a social media post. He wrote that they had strength, wisdom, and love of our country, which is right now very proud of you. Until 2020, justices named to the bench by Republican presidents held a slim 5-4 majority. That solidified when Mr. Trump nominated Justice Barrett to the court following the death of liberal Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The decision Friday to reject Mr. Trump's signature economic initiative, however, cut across ideological lines. But even in the majority coalition of conservatives and liberals, there were sharp disagreements. The justices stated their reasoning in four separate concurring opinions, potentially an indication of why it took the court more than 3 months after the case was argued in early November to issue its ruling. Friday's opinion gives the lie to the notion that the court is in the bag for the president and also makes its approach to issues of presidential power in Trump 2.0 both clearer and more nuanced. Jack Goldsmith, a Harvard law professor and a former top Justice Department lawyer under George W. Bush, wrote in a blog post. The biggest disagreement among all the justices was over whether and how to apply the so-called major questions doctrine, which requires Congress to use clear language to authorize executive action with vast economic and political consequences. Chief Justice Roberts said that the president could not point to clear congressional authorization to justify his extraordinary assertion of the power to impose tariffs. He invoked the same principle in 2023 to invalidate President Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s student loan forgiveness program. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh, who have similar backgrounds, often vote together and are both strong proponents of executive power. Both worked as lawyers in the administrations of Republican presidents. Chief Justice Roberts for George H.W. Bush and Justice Kavanaugh for George W. Bush. As they parted ways on Friday over the major questions doctrine, Justice Kavanaugh has joined decisions applying the doctrine in the past, but has said it does not apply when it comes to foreign affairs and the president's power to declare a national emergency, as Mr. Trump did in imposing tariffs. In the foreign affairs realm, courts recognize that Congress often deliberately grants flexibility and discretion to the president to pursue America's interests, Justice Kavanaugh wrote, joined by Justices Thomas and Alito. That echoed Justice Kavanaugh's views as a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit and in his opinion last year in a case involving the Federal Communications Commission, in which he said the major questions doctrine has not been applied by this court in the national security or foreign policy context because it does not reflect ordinary congressional intent in those areas. The issue split even the ideologically diverse majority in the Friday decision. Justice Elena Kagan, joined by the two other liberals, said there was no need to apply the doctrine because the language in the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977 that Mr. Trump used to impose tariffs, known as IEEPA, simply did not permit the president to do so. Another member of the majority, Justice Gorsuch, wrote separately to reinforce his views on preserving legislative powers and checking the unbounded delegation of core congressional powers like taxation to the president. In all, the legislative process helps ensure each of us has a stake in the laws that govern us and in the nation's future, he wrote in a 46-page concurrence. He added, for some today, the weight of those virtues is apparent. For others, it may not seem so obvious. But if history is any guide, the tables will turn, and the day will come when those disappointed by today's result will appreciate the legislative process for the bulwark of liberty it is. Although they reached the same outcome, Justices Barrett and Kagan pushed back on Justice Gorsuch's take on their separate writings. Mr. Garr said in an email that even with the varying opinions among the justices, it's hard not to see the decision, however, as an extension and perhaps most important step in the court's unwillingness to infer broad grants of executive authority hidden in routine statutory language. Trump pulls support from House Republicans who opposed tariffs. The president yanked his endorsement of Representative Jeff Hurd of Colorado, imperiling Republicans' chances of holding onto his seat as they brace for midterm losses, by Megan Monero and Tim Balk. President Trump on Saturday withdrew his endorsement of Representative Jeff Hurd of Colorado, punishing a Republican who opposed his tariffs in a move that could further imperil his party's chances of keeping control of the House in November's midterm elections. In yanking his support and throwing his backing behind Mr. Hurd's right-wing primary opponent, Mr. Trump was making good on a threat he issued this month as the House was voting to cancel his tariffs on Canada. The president posted on social media that any Republican who backed lifting the levies would seriously suffer the consequences come election time, and that includes primaries. Mr. Hurd was one of only six Republicans to join nearly all House Democrats in doing so, casting a largely symbolic vote that was a rare instance of Congress trying to assert its authority over the Trump administration. The president's vengeful maneuver injected an element of uncertainty in what was already expected to be a competitive race in Mr. Hurd's Republican-leaning western and southern Colorado district. It also signaled that Mr. Trump's tariffs and his demand that Republicans support them are likely to continue to be a vexing issue for his party in midterm elections, in which they already have an uphill fight to keep control of Congress. In an angry social media post on Saturday, Mr. Trump branded Mr. Hurd, a first-term congressman who is a member of the center-right Republican Main Street Partnership, a RINO, short for Republican in name only, and said he was one of a small number of legislators who have let me and our country down. He endorsed the congressman's primary opponent, Hope Shepelman, a Navy veteran and a former nurse practitioner whom Republicans voted to remove from her post as vice chair of the state party in 2024 after a backlash to anti-gay posts and other extreme positions taken by the party chairman. Mr. Hurd, a former lawyer, has been outspoken in opposition to the president's sweeping tariffs, which he has said have directly harmed agriculture and steel producers in his district. He's also been among the few Republicans who have pushed back on Mr. Trump's unilateral tariffs on constitutional grounds. After the Supreme Court ruled on Friday that Mr. Trump had exceeded his authority when he imposed the tariffs on nearly every U.S. trading partner, Mr. Hurd said in a post on social media that the ruling underscores the need for Congress to play its proper role in trade policy. That position appears to have enraged Mr. Trump, who said in his own post on Saturday, Mr. Hurd is more interested in protecting foreign countries that have been ripping us off for decades than he is in the United States of America. The office of the congressman did not respond to a request for comment. The vote on the Canada tariffs was the first opportunity for House members to formally register a position on Mr. Trump's trade policies, after Republican leaders blocked such a vote for nearly a year. But with the president demanding loyalty on the issue, several Republicans facing competitive re-election races, including two other Coloradans, Representatives Jeff Crank and Gabe Evans, voted against canceling the tariffs. Mr. Hurd in 2024 defeated a Democrat by 5 points in the race for Colorado's 3rd congressional district, previously represented by a hard-right GOP representative, Lauren Boebert, who switched districts to run in a solidly Republican area and preserve her chances of re-election. Ms. Shepelman is regarded in the state as a polarizing figure. She was seen as acting in concert with Dave Williams, chairman of the Colorado Republican Party, when members voted in 2024 to oust both of them in response to posts by Mr. Williams that attacked the LGBTQ community and accusations that he had fueled divisions within the party. Dick Wadhams, a Republican strategist in Colorado and a former Republican Party chairman in the state, described Ms. Shepelman as a very divisive figure who was deeply invested in 2020 election conspiracies. The fact is, he said in an interview on Saturday, if she is the Republican nominee in the 3rd District, Democrats will win that district. Alan Fuller, a Colorado Republican consultant, said in a statement that Ms. Shepelman was a limited candidate with a limited base, limited runway, and limited options. C.J. Warnke, a spokesman for the House Majority PAC, the Political Action Committee focused on electing Democrats, said the group was looking forward to flipping Hurd's seat blue in November, and Trump's unendorsement is speeding up that process. J.P. Morgan admits it shut Trump's accounts after the January 6 Capitol attack. Nation's largest bank, in response to a lawsuit filed by the president, confirmed his long-standing complaint about debanking by Rob Copeland. For years, President Trump has complained that his personal and business bank accounts were deliberately closed after the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. J.P. Morgan Chase is now admitting that did happen. In a response to a lawsuit filed last month by Mr. Trump and the Trump Organization, J.P. Morgan, the nation's largest bank, said for the first time late Friday that it cut off more than 50 Trump accounts in February 2021, shortly after Mr. Trump's first term ended. The accounts included those for Trump hotels, housing developments, and retail shops in Illinois, Florida, and New York, as well as for Mr. Trump's personal private banking relationship that handled his inheritance from his father, according to letters filed to the court. J.P. Morgan did not specify in those letters a specific reason for the mass account closings. In one unsigned note to Mr. Trump dated February 19, 2021, the bank wrote that he would need to find a more suitable institution with which to conduct business. The letter closed with, "Thank you for your prompt attention to this matter," a phrase that Mr. Trump himself is fond of using. Mr. Trump's lawsuit, which named Jamie Dimon, J.P. Morgan's chief executive, as a defendant, contended that the bank put Mr. Trump on a blacklist because it needed to distance itself from President Trump and his conservative political views. That echoed earlier complaints from Mr. Trump that Capital One similarly closed his accounts and the Bank of America refused to accept billions of dollars in deposits after the January 6 riots. The issue of whether and why the nation's largest banks took action against Mr. Trump has become a matter of public importance because the president has frequently invoked his personal experience in pushing for a broad crackdown on debanking. Bank executives have capitalized on his enthusiasm for the issue to push successfully for looser enforcement by federal agencies of rules and regulations that instruct lenders to scrutinize their clients for reputational risk, among other issues. J.P. Morgan, until now, had gone to lengths to avoid addressing whether it had actually closed Mr. Trump's accounts. In a statement last month, it described the lawsuit as without merits, but did not address the specifics of Mr. Trump's allegations. A bank's spokeswoman said then that as a rule, J.P. Morgan closed accounts because they create legal or regulatory risk for the company. The J.P. Morgan spokeswoman did not respond to a request for comment on Saturday. A spokesman for Mr. Trump's legal team said, "President Trump is standing up for all those wrongly debanked by J.P. Morgan Chase and their cohorts, and will see this case to a just and proper conclusion." There is still much legal wrangling to come. J.P. Morgan this past week asked the case be moved from Florida state court, where Mr. Trump has had some success in litigation, to a federal court in New York. Blizzard warnings issued for a swath of East Coast, including New York City. The blizzard warnings are the first since 2017 for New York City. Forecasters said the city is expected to get up to 18 inches of snow, with 2 feet possible. By Isabella Quay, Judson Jones, and Amy Graff. A fierce storm was poised to blast the mid-Atlantic and northeast with heavy snow and strong winds Sunday into Monday, leading forecasters to issue blizzard warnings for much of the coastal northeast, including New York City, which faces as much as 2 feet of snow. The storm is expected to bring heavy snowfall, strong winds, and blizzard conditions from Delaware to southern Connecticut, the National Weather Service said on early Saturday. Brian Hurley, a meteorologist with the Weather Prediction Center, said the winds will bring the blizzard conditions but also create other problems, including moderate to major flooding and high surf at the coast. He also said there could be widespread power outages, with Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, Rhode Island, and eastern Massachusetts at the highest risk. The blizzard warnings were in place for nearly 30 million people from Sunday morning until Monday afternoon, with the heaviest snowfall, 1 to 2 inches per hour, if not more, expected by Sunday night, the Weather Service said. Forecasters warn travel will be dangerous, if not impossible, on roads as it became clear that the Monday morning and evening commutes will be messy in the big cities from Washington, D.C. to Philadelphia to New York City to Boston. As of Saturday night, more than 1,500 flights across the United States were being canceled for Sunday, according to the flight tracking site FlightAware. At LaGuardia Airport, 338 flights were canceled. Kennedy International Airport had 493 flights canceled, and Newark Liberty International Airport had 284. It's the first blizzard warning in Manhattan in 9 years. This is the first blizzard warning issued for New York City since 2017, according to the Weather Service. There was also a blizzard warning for the city the year before in 2016, when a record-breaking snowstorm dumped and accumulated 27.5 inches of snow onto Central Park, the largest since records began in 1869. The city has not experienced near blizzard conditions in 4 years, but in the coming days, New York City, as well as Long Island, Northeast New Jersey, and coastal and southern Connecticut, could get 15 to 20 inches or more of accumulated snow, the Weather Service said. Sustained winds of 25 to 35 miles per hour were also expected, and the Weather Service warned that the wind, combined with snow loads, could down tree limbs and cause power outages. There is also a risk to waterfront areas. Parts of coastal New Jersey and New York were placed under a flood watch starting Sunday evening. The Weather Service warned that roads could also become impassable and that low-lying buildings near the waterfront were at risk of moderate flooding. Cars parked near the immediate waterfront could be submerged, it said. Unlike January's storm in New York, which was heavily advertised for a week in advance, the incoming storm will be windier and the snow wetter. This is going to be heavy stuff for the people who have to shovel, Mr. Hurley said. Mayor Zoran Mamdani said at a news conference on Saturday that sanitation workers were loading up more than 700 salt spreaders and mounting plows on 2,200 vehicles. A fleet of 2,600 workers, including 1,000 emergency snow shovelers, will take to the streets early on Sunday and work through the day as the weather intensifies, he added. He said the city will be counting on everyday New Yorkers and will even pay them to join the cleanup as the snow begins to fall on Sunday morning. Residents will be able to show up at their local sanitation department facility and sign up. For those who want to do more to help their neighbors earn some extra cash, you too can become an emergency snow shoveler, he said. The storm will hit Washington, D.C. first with rain and snow. Forecasters are calling this system an intense and classic nor'easter, a storm that develops off the mid-Atlantic and rapidly intensifies near the coast, delivering punishing northeast winds and blowing deep snow into coastal northeast cities. In this case, the storm is predicted to develop off the coast of the Carolinas overnight and then move northward, staying offshore but hugging the coast. By early Sunday morning, it will be off the coast of the mid-Atlantic and rapidly intensify. When storms strengthen, their barometric pressure drops. If the pressure drops 24 millibars in 24 hours, the storm is considered a bomb cyclone. Mr. Hurley said that with this system, the pressure is predicted to drop 24 millibars in less than 12 hours. Washington, D.C. will get hit with some of the first precipitation early on Sunday morning. Initially, the precipitation will fall as a mix of rain and snow before transitioning to snow by midday. Washington is expected to record up to 5 inches of snow. Snowfall totals are expected to be higher the farther north you go. Philadelphia is predicted to get up to a foot of snow. A winter storm warning was issued for the city from Sunday morning to Monday night. Light snow showers could start falling in New York City before the sun rises on Sunday, with snowfall rates picking up in the early afternoon and the heaviest snow falling Sunday evening into Monday morning. The Central Park weather gauge is forecast to record 18 inches of snow, but James Tomasini, a meteorologist with the Weather Service office in Upton, New York, said that up to 2 feet is possible. Mr. Tomasini said the snowfall totals in New York are dependent on how close the storm gets to shore. The closer it gets, the higher the totals. In Boston, where a blizzard warning was issued for the first time since 2022, snowfall totals could reach up to 2 feet. The fresh snow will be falling on the snow from the last storm that's piled up on roadsides, much of it old and dirty. The storm was expected to bring some of the most severe weather to eastern Massachusetts, stirring up strong winds in places like Cape Cod and Nantucket, where isolated gusts could reach over 70 miles per hour. "There are going to be numerous power outages," Mr. Hurley said. "That's going to be a problem because you want people to stay warm." The Queen stuck by Andrew. King Charles is pulling away. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, the former prince, is getting no help from the throne as the crisis over his ties to Jeffrey Epstein intensifies. By Sarah Lyle. In March 2022, the man still known as Prince Andrew was in disgrace, his reputation shredded by increasingly lurid revelations about his ties to the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Stripped of his royal duties and military titles, he had just paid a multi-million-dollar settlement to Virginia Goffrey, a victim of Mr. Epstein's trafficking network, who said Andrew had sexually assaulted her when she was a teenager. Nevertheless, Andrew was front and center at the memorial service for his father, Prince Philip. He accompanied his 95-year-old mother, Queen Elizabeth II, from Windsor, then escorted her into Westminster Abbey. If the Queen indulged and protected Andrew all his life, he would get no such treatment from King Charles III, who has responded to each new unsavory turn in his brother's scandal by taking away more of the trappings of his royal life, money, status, and titles. Though Andrew took his place with the royal family at Elizabeth's funeral later that year, Charles forbade him to wear his military uniform. Andrew attended his brother's coronation, but was assigned an ignominious seat in the third row of the abbey. Last fall, Charles stripped him of his last vestige of his royal identity. "No more Prince Andrew, no more Duke of York," decreeing that he simply be called Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. And on Thursday, when the former prince was arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office, Charles released an unusual statement that had, by Windsor standards, the sharpness and savagery of a guillotine. "Most royal statements are written in an anodyne third-person voice, conveying the thoughts of his or her majesty, but this one began with I, offering the unfiltered, if formal, words of an angry king. I have learned with the deepest concerns the news about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor," Charles wrote, adding that the authorities would have our full and wholehearted support and cooperation. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor, who was held by the police for more than 10 hours, has not been charged with a crime and has long denied any wrongdoing in connection with Mr. Epstein. He has issued no public statement since his arrest. Even apart from his ties to the toxic Mr. Epstein or the conduct now under investigation, there have long been concerns about Mr. Mountbatten Windsor's behavior, which has been often marked by recklessness, greed, or poor judgment. But the current state of affairs also involves the dynamics of his rarefied, dysfunctional family, and in particular his relationship with his older brother. Charles, the oldest of four siblings born in 1948, was an introspective and sensitive boy, prone to self-pity, more bookish than athletic. He felt chronically misunderstood by his parents, especially the no-nonsense, caustic Prince Philip. The sporty Andrew was easier for Philip to like, and he had a cheeky exuberance that endeared him to his doting mother. "The baby is adorable," the Queen wrote after Andrew's birth in 1960. "He's going to be terribly spoilt by all of this." Elizabeth had been a distant, formal parent to Charles and his sister Anne, but she was far more hands-on with Andrew and her youngest child, Edward, born in 1964. Charles and Anne got very different parenting styles to Edward and Andrew. Catherine Mayer, the author of Charles, Heart of a King, said in an interview, "It was almost like they had different parents." If Charles spent much of his pre-king life mired in self-doubt about his role in the world, a Hamlet on the Thames, yearning for something he couldn't define, Andrew was brash and self-confident, seemingly untethered from any notion that he had a duty to anything but his self-enrichment. The tabloids called him Randy Andy for his busy life as a bachelor. "They are opposites," said Jordy Gregg, editor-in-chief of The Independent and a veteran royal criminologist. "Andrew is bovine, philistine, and opines with great inanity and self-importance, while Charles is hugely sophisticated." Baked into the relationship, thanks to birth order and the ancient system of primogeniture, is the fact that Charles inherited not just the job of monarch, but the perks and money that come with it. Andrew and the two other siblings, while hardly living in penury, have less money of their own and few obvious ways to earn enough to live in the style to which they think they should be accustomed. When Charles reduced Andrew to commoner status, he ejected him from the Grand Royal Lodge in Windsor, sending him to live in a much more modest house on the royal estate in Sandringham, Norfolk, some 140 miles away. Charles and Andrew have never seemed close, and over the years have rarely appeared in public together, except at mandatory occasions like the annual Trooping the Colour Parade, when the royal family appears en masse on a Buckingham Palace balcony and waves to the crowds below. Neither Charles nor his sons, for instance, attended the lavish, masked ball that Andrew and his ex-wife Sarah Ferguson threw at Windsor Castle in 2006 for their daughter Beatrice's 18th birthday, for a reported cost of £400,000. The guests did include friends of Andrew, like Harvey Weinstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, and Mr. Epstein. Andrew's service in the Royal Navy from 1979 to 2001 included a successful stint in the Falklands War that briefly earned him the war hero status. After he left the military, his mother appointed him Britain's special representative for international trade and investment. The police now appear to be investigating his conduct in that role, amid reports that he may have improperly shared government documents with Mr. Epstein. The job came with a salary of about £250,000 paid by the Queen and provided so many opportunities for lavish taxpayer-financed travel to vacation spots and hobnobbing with dubious foreign leaders that the Prince gained a new tabloid nickname, Air Miles Andy. One royal historian, Andrew Lowney, wrote that Charles saw the appointment as a disaster waiting to happen and tried unsuccessfully to block it. In his book entitled The Rise and Fall of the House of York, Mr. Lowney quotes a royal source as saying that Charles thought Andrew would not be able to resist the temptation of mixing business with pleasure. But the Queen, reportedly backed by Peter Mandelson, the Labour Party politician now disgraced by his own ties to Mr. Epstein, was adamant that Andrew should get the job, and courtiers had learned not to bring complaints about Andrew to her. Elizabeth did not think that there was a distinction between protecting the monarchy and protecting Andrew. Ms. Mayer said. She believed that protecting the monarchy was her duty as a monarch, and that protecting him was her duty as his mother. Charles is 77. With both of his parents gone, it's up to him, and to some extent his son, Prince William, who is said to loathe his uncle, to find a way to preserve both their family and the monarchy at this precarious moment. Mr. Mountbatten's arrest and the haunting photograph of him slumped in the back seat of a car after his interrogation have renewed calls for an overhaul of the institution. Prime Minister Keir Starmer is said to be considering legislation that would change the rules of succession to remove Andrew from his position as eighth in line to the throne. Charles has always put duty ahead of everything, and there is a profound sense of sadness on his behalf that everything he is trying to do is in jeopardy, said Russell Myers, the royal editor of the Daily Mirror tabloid and author of the forthcoming William and Catherine, The Monarchy's New Era, The Inside Story, which delves into Andrew's problematic role in the family. The worry is that this is threatening to be one of the defining moments of his reign, he said. What to know about the search for Nancy Guthrie? Day 21, where things stand. The hunt for Nancy Guthrie, the 84-year-old mother of the Today Show host Savannah Guthrie, has extended to its 21st day. The authorities have said they believe she was abducted from her home near Tucson, Arizona, early on February 1. As the days have passed since her last known sighting, developments have intermittently surfaced, but none of them have led to an arrest. Here's what we know. The sheriff clears all of the Guthrie family members. More than 2 weeks into the investigation, Chris Nanos, the Pima County sheriff, cleared all members of the Guthrie family, including all siblings and spouses, as possible suspects. It was the first time that Sheriff Nanos had ruled anyone out in the course of the investigation. The family has been nothing but cooperative and gracious and are victims in this case, he said in a statement. To suggest otherwise is not only wrong, it is cruel. The Guthrie family are victims, plain and simple. Police seek to match DNA found in gloves. The FBI on Sunday said that gloves found about 2 miles from Miss Guthrie's home had an unknown man's DNA on them, and that it would put the DNA profile into a database in an effort to identify the person. The FBI said that the gloves appeared to match those worn by the man who was captured on Ms. Guthrie's doorbell camera on the night she was abducted. The FBI added that most of the other gloves recovered during its searches were those of investigators who had discarded them while conducting sweeps near the home. A sheriff's department spokeswoman previously said that investigators found DNA on Nancy Guthrie's party, a property that was neither hers nor that of anyone in close contact with her. The police did not say where the DNA was found. A flurry of activity happened 2 miles from Nancy Guthrie's home. Late on Friday night, law enforcement officials swarmed an upscale subdivision 2 miles from Nancy Guthrie's home in the Catalina Foothills area of Tucson, searching a house as well as a Range Rover parked at a nearby Culver's. The Pima County Sheriff's Department said that a federal court-ordered search warrant was executed at the home. A traffic stop was also conducted and a person was questioned, but there were no arrests. The police also investigated a house on the edge of the Catalina Foothills neighborhood, a short drive from Nancy Guthrie's home and the home of her older daughter and son-in-law, the Sheriff's Department said. The authorities briefly detained a man but released him after questioning. The authorities released surveillance footage from Ms. Guthrie's doorstep showing a man standing at her front door wearing a ski mask, gloves, and a backpack on the morning of her disappearance. The sheriff's department said the man was wearing clothing that can be purchased at Walmart, but noted that it is also available elsewhere. a timeline, but few clues. The investigation into Ms. Guthrie's disappearance began after she failed to arrive at a friend's house to watch a live-streamed church service on February 1. Early in the investigation, Sheriff Nanos described Ms. Guthrie's home as a crime scene. Ms. Guthrie has limited mobility and requires medication every 24 hours, but is mentally sharp, according to the authorities. Ms. Guthrie's pacemaker app showed that it had been disconnected from her phone at 2:28 a.m. on the night of her disappearance, indicating she was no longer near the phone, which was left inside her house. The Guthries said they would pay a ransom. Savannah Guthrie and her siblings have released a series of videos pleading with whoever is involved in their mother's disappearance to contact them. They also said that they are willing to pay for their mother's return. "We still have hope and we still believe," Savannah Guthrie said in a video posted Sunday, 2 weeks after her mother disappeared. "I wanted to say to whoever has her or knows where she is that it's never too late." Officials were investigating a message. The authority said in the week after her disappearance that they were reviewing a message sent to a Tucson television station. They did not confirm whether it was related to a purported ransom note sent to several news outlets after Ms. Guthrie's disappearance, which demanded millions of dollars in Bitcoin. Savannah Guthrie withdrew from the NBC's Olympics coverage. Savannah Guthrie, 54, is best known as one of the anchors of the NBC morning show Today, a job she's held since 2012. She joined NBC News in 2007 after working in local news and as a lawyer. She did not go to Italy for the Milan Cortina Olympics, where she'd been expected to play a key role in NBC's coverage of the games. Savannah Guthrie grew up and attended college in Tucson, Arizona. She lives in New York with her husband, the communication consultant Michael Feldman, and their two children. NBA Rookie Rankings: This Class Runs Deep Behind Cooper Flagg by Sam Vecini. Now that the All-Star break has passed and the stretch run of the season is upon us, it's the perfect time to update the 2026 NBA Rookie Rankings. It's been an incredibly fun rookie class to break down. We have a great Rookie of the Year race between Cooper Flagg and Con Knipple. Beyond them, about 10 players could make a first-team all-rookie push, and some seriously fun breakout players are emerging mid-season. I'm enthused by what seems to be a very deep class of potential rotation players. A refresher on this exercise: we rank the league's top 15 rookies based on how they played in the NBA thus far, not as a projection of who they will become. This is a full-season ranking, not based on who is playing the best right now. Flagg starting to take over games. I didn't expect to write about Flagg after doing so in each of the previous two iterations of the rookie rankings, but Flagg is taking massive leaps every month that are impossible to ignore. As the number one option on the Dallas Mavericks, Flagg is starting to dominate games. Over Flagg's last 9 games, he's averaging 27.4 points, 8 rebounds, and 4 assists, and that run includes the game against the Charlotte Hornets, in which he went for 49 points to set the NBA scoring record for a teenager. He followed that game up with 34 points against the Houston Rockets, 36 points against the Boston Celtics, 32 points against the San Antonio Spurs, and then another 27 points against the Phoenix Suns. What stands out the most is the way he's modulated his aggressiveness. He's hitting shots more than he has at any point in his rookie season, but he no longer looks sped up, as with many rookies. Flagg has slowed down to create more advantages. Flagg's superpower has always been his ability to create leverage on his opponent by playing with great bend combined with his explosiveness. But early in his rookie year, things looked fast for him as he tried to adjust to the speed of the game. He wasn't quite flailing, but he wasn't maximizing his tools. Now, though, you can see that he understands how to maintain his space, using that flexibility to get lower than his opposition. It looks like he has more time to think out there. He's better at keeping defenders on his hip out of ball screens while maintaining his own space. When he attacks closeouts, it's incredibly hard for defenders to get back in front of him because of how well he uses his positioning to keep his space. And as we mentioned last month, don't sleep on his left hand. Because of his ambidexterity, he can go to the rim with ease and create angles with touch that other creators at this age can't achieve. There were several great examples of that from his recent game against Houston, when he drove and went up with his left to finish around and over the top of guys like Alperen Sengun. Because Flagg has figured out how to use his frame and physicality at the NBA level, he's become a freight train. He uses his shoulders to shrug defenders off him in a way that star creator in their mid-20s do. The fearlessness and power that we've seen from him at every level has arrived, and it's getting harder for defenses to keep in front of him. He's always been excellent at using his off-arm to create a bit of space without getting called for a foul. But unlike earlier in the season, he's now driving opposing players backwards as opposed to them standing him up. This playing out in transition from last week was a prime example when he moved Dylan Brooks out of the way before throwing down a thunderous slam. Brooks is a great defender and a tough physical player. Flagg moved him like he wasn't even there. Plays like the ones above make you forget that Flagg is only 19 years old. And that's all the time we have for today. Stay safe and thank you for listening.